Good evening, everybody, and welcome to Evelyn's show.
Hooray.
Hello.
Just do you wanna intro it so I don't waffle over you?
Yeah, we're, I don't know, but the usual stuff, I suppose, of thank people for sort of tuning in and whatever else, and showing up to watch, and the folk that are members and donate and what have you. This is very
Yes.
useful. It keeps the whole thing running.
The normal shilling does apply.
Yes.
Our links are down below. We're still monetized by some miracle. And if you want to have a question read out, the best way to do it is through Streamlabs. That's the normal YouTube-y stuff out the way. I'll put a quick note for people to refresh in the chat, because sometimes people don't quite catch it. But today we are talking. It's an interesting one, because this is. It's something that needs a lot more research doing on it.
Yes, this is my like maybe 2 or 3 hours worth of skimming stuff on it over the course of a couple of days, and just kind of murmuring over it and thinking about it and sort of applying what I know elsewhere and what I hope other people, there's possibly some assumed knowledge coming into this stream that you, excuse me, that you have a rough reference point to what things like Agenda 2030 and the UN climate goals and what used to be called Agenda 21 and these dates like 2030 and how these tie into a lot of these.
There we go. Sorry, I think I dropped out for a second there.
Yeah, the OBS disconnected. I don't know where we ended up. Okay.
It seems to be back now.
Give me a second while I get the chat back up.
Sorry about that. I think actually YouTube took a shit there, because my internet didn't die, and I don't think your internet died. Everything was fine apart from YouTube. Apparently there's background noise now. I don't know, I don't really hear it, but
I'm not sure, that might be the fan as OBS starts back up again, because OBS seemed to reset itself or something like that.
yeah, as Evelyn talks, the gain will adjust on the microphone. Unfortunately, we do have a bit of background noise there, but no, I think that was YouTube having a hiccup there.
All right. Well, I don't know. I think I had mentioned something along the lines of I'm hoping people are coming in with sort of at least some kind of reference point for the eco agenda, as it were, which has been a long developing thing now. I mean, it's kind of funny to look at it as a product of a movement that now seems to go on, what, from at least the sort of 80s in some kind of mainstream way, surely.
Yes, it's a long running thing. One of the equations, even just on the surface of it, if you take the rewilding movement, for those of you who don't know, should we quickly actually explain what rewilding is to people?
Yes, I mean, I'll get the one of the, I think this is essentially the major institute in the UK for rewilding activism and policy, and as a sort of major pressure group. Their goal is to buy up, or we'll get to the buying up, but to take, I think, something like 5% of the land in the UK and turn it into quote unquote re you know these I think they have a name for it, these sort of core, what do they call them, sorry. Yeah, these different sort of sectors of the economy that the wish the economy, sorry, I've completely lost my train of thought there. Yeah, I don't know, would you rather explain? I seem to have misplaced myself.
Well, what they're looking for is that it's one of their pillars of how they want to redevelop this new kind of post climate change, post industrial world. Of one of their pillars of this is they want all this natural space. Basically, their idea is that they want to put Britain back on a footing where there is all basically these giant nature reserves is the idea.
Yes,
And
it's.
it all seems very good and nice and almost hippie-ish that we're going to put Britain back to its natural status, but it's kind of a lie.
Yes, it's an integral part of a lot of the green economy plans, I think, that they would be referred to.
Wait, who's got what's with the tinnitus? Sorry, this yeah, the green economy plan is where the problem is, where the problem lies in general. I think the rewilding stuff hasn't really hit people's radar because it just, again, as you'll start seeing in these articles, they end up, you know, talking about it being hippie-ish and misguided and all of this. They end up kind of dismissing it as a pipe dream, but underneath it is something a little bit more sinister. In that the
Yes.
fact that they are looking to, if this goes through successfully, they are looking to reduce massively the amount of arable land that is accessible in Britain. Therefore, you know, one, driving up the value of other arable land, and two, meaning that the only people that have the resources to make this land arable again will be massive multinationals.
Yes.
Rewilded land becomes basically worthless without these schemes running.
Well, that's exactly the point. I mean, there is the numbers here, and it's a bit, you've kind of got to do a bit of jumping about the website to get some proper numbers, shall we say. But I, you know, looked up total amount of agricultural land in the UK. It was something along the lines of, I think it was anywhere between 16 and 18 million hectares, which has obviously decreased as of the last year of 2020. So God knows what it is now.
Yeah.
Two thirds of that is not actually croppable, and then of that croppable land, I think at most half of that gets used, which ends up working out to anywhere between like 3 to 4, maybe even 5 million hectares possibly, and they're talking about using up maybe 1.2 million
Yeah.
if they trust their numbers. And somewhere else on their site it says 1 million hectares by 2030,
Yeah.
and if you designate, you know, that portion of hectares to each one of these types of land they're planning to look at. This is totally not looking at the other 30% of coastal regions and, as they describe them, offshore ecosystems. That however much that's going to cost, you're talking about at least like nearly 70 million quid. So it's no small
Yes.
fee, and that's not including the cost of, you know, actually acquiring the land, actually doing the original things that need to be done so it can be considered rewilded land, and then they can, you know, apply their annual standard payments.
Another aspect I see to this is that they're asking nicely now, and they're offering the, you know, they're offering a carrot now, but you may end up in a situation with a climate policy where you have enforce rewilding or encourage rewilding, or you have policies that make farming less and less viable on land that they would want in quotes rewilded. A lot of this has appeared all at once
Well,
in government policy.
they do very much right at the start here. They play into the, you know, the climate emergency across the UK. You know, they're playing into that unbelievably sort of existential, despite how normally materialist the framing is of any issue. That, you know, you get these videos of all these icebergs melting and the walls collapsing on the glaciers, and David Attenborough speaks to you in a very sort of close kind of, I don't know how to describe it, a very close and kind of emotional tone.
Yeah.
This is the greatest conquest, this is what man was destined for, and oh, it never ends.
All that guff. Well,
Yes.
these would just be wackos who want to essentially let the earth lay fallow. If it weren't for the fact that they seem to have an extremely large amount of backing,
Yes.
rewilding has become, as I talked about repeatedly, as we've talked about actually, the activist class do not have the power to bring about change without being lifted up on these pedestals by the power structure.
Well,
There are,
it's 'cause it's convenient, let's be honest.
there are thousands of causes you will never hear about that, you know, hundreds of thousands of people may passionately believe in, but, you know, the power structure just doesn't care.
Yeah, I
The
mean, I've.
fact that rewilding is part of the debate, and the fact that rewilding grants, I know we talked about it a little bit off air, but actually it comes up on the series Clarkson's Farm, where he talks about the fact that these rewilding grants, both from the EU and the UK government, are actually less risky and a more surefire way of gaining income from your land than actually farming many produce.
Whilst also driving the value of land upwards in general, in the same way you would do if you were to, you know, I mean, it's like we could look at it in a really weird class war kind of way.
Yes.
The landed gentry has realized they can't hold money anymore, it's not worth anything, but they're not going to be making any more land, and they're not going to be making any more arable land. So just sit on it. Sit on it. What are you going to do? You know, say you own 600 hectares of arable land in Britain across a number of farms. If it's, you know, in theory, you could turn half of it into rewilding profit, or sorry, land, and your other 300 acres would be worth more.
Yes,
Like
they would.
hectares,
It's
sorry.
like the social housing policy of land.
Yeah.
For those of you who follow economics more closely, you'll realize that creating social housing drives up the price of other housing because it artificially limits supply. It takes a lot of housing out of the housing market, and rewilding does this one using taxpayer money to basically pay people and drive up the value of land. But two, as you said, it's the double whammy of land is more expensive because it's a more surefire income from being wildland. You don't have to do anything to it. And two, as more wildland comes on tap and replaces farmland, farmland itself becomes more valuable, and the produce from farms become more expensive. Well, the rewilding stuff he was talking about was the fact that if he was to literally just abandon the farm whilst owning the land, it not even crop rotation, it would have to be permanent rewilding. He's not talking about land recovery. In fact, it's very difficult once that something has been rewilded for a certain amount of time to turn it back into arable land. It takes a large amount of plowing to get the soil pliable enough to, you know, use things like seed drills in.
But
That's why farmland takes so much maintenance.
to come back to that very simple sort of quantitative economic question, though, it then becomes no wonder why the main backer for this specific organization is, I can't quite remember the name of it now, but if you dig around on their website and you look for their backers, their top backer is some hedge fund in London that manages £27.6 billion worth of assets, which isn't BlackRock by any means, but it's also not nothing.
No, and it also could be a lot of these independent hedge funds are offshoots of larger entities. They'll be underwritten by, say, Deutsche Bank,
Oh no,
or they.
I well understand that. That's again one of those things I'm kind of assuming the people coming into this are aware of, is that, you know, this is just a front for another UN group, that's just a front for a different group who are essentially all a big think tank of people that meet at like the World Bank or the IMF.
Yeah, this is a registered charity as well, which is how a lot of this stuff is cleared. But yeah, you are correct. If you could dig out the name of that, that would be great. But they are backed by a, you said it was like £27 billion hedge fund, which is quite a lot.
This is that's trustees. Where was it? I don't know. I had to kind of our funding. There we go. It's in a submenu. Tricky. There you go. Artemis Foundation.
The Artemis
Yes,
Foundation.
and you've got the Artemis Foundation website. Oh
Who
no, I've got.
are the Artemis Foundation?
I've got some cookie nonsense. I'm afraid I'm gonna have to close that. But you can. It is there. You can look them up, and you will find that they manage quite a lot of money. And there are other, you know, these foundations, charities. I had a look at some of these. Some of these are just family ones. Some of them are corporate. Some of them are just very clearly like a front for.
Yeah, you've got NGOs and charities. That are basically feeding NGOs and charities, the money becomes very circular. This is what I explain to people about things like Extinction Rebellion and Insulate Britain and all those people, that their sources of funding are relatively opaque. But what we can tell is that most of the people who end up, you know, in these places, who end up at the, you know, becoming professional activists, are employed by these NGOs or these universities, and that's how they all make their money.
And
They all come.
what I was gonna say, what they do is they appeal to a higher racket of public service agent. So there's a sort of, you'll notice as well as we get into the articles and not necessarily the institutes, that a lot of this stuff all seems to just kind of come out of nowhere in a popularization in about the middle of last year. But there's this. Some, you know, Julia Davis, sold a share of some massive outdoor equipment company, entrepreneur, lawyer, up to all sorts of stuff. Turns out she's got £4 million to lend to the Wildlife Trust to acquire ownership and create a nature park and 170 hectares of fields and meadows that surrounded a farm.
Yes. Sorry, I'm just looking at all of this. There's so many foundations here, and there's other charitable organizations. They're funded by other charitable trusts, and the vast majority of their funding, though, comes from these quote-unquote foundations, these other foundations that circularly fund each other. Sorry, you were saying about the all these hectares of land.
Well, no, it's just that, you know, bought a big portion of land, she's got 4 million squid lying around to lend to the Wildlife Trust, which I'd imagine she's getting a nice dividend on when the wildlife rewilding Britain people turn up and charge an absorbing amount of money to tend to the land in a way that nature used to just do. I mean, I love that aspect of it. There is just a completely callous and transparent managerialism in all these, like, senior and extremely well-serviced veteran public service people coming out and deciding that you need to pay them a mountain of money so they can manage nature.
Yeah, they've essentially monetized nature in, like, a state sense.
Mm.
They've created the Department of Nature.
Mm. Well, I mean,
and they're going to run it.
It's not quite the same framing in this, but
no.
In some of the other ones, especially in the foundation documents, I mean, it's obvious that they're going to play that framing, but not one of them at any point challenges the fact that there are other means for government money to be spent on, which is, like, the fundamental lesson, like, Hazlitt is trying to teach in economic... it's been so long since I've thought about that book now. Economic Lessons in One, or whatever it is, the really good intro to, you know, sort of quasi-Austrian thinking. But that's very much a key point, and it shows that there is no thought given to just justifying what they're doing outside of its effect on the climate. You know, they're not trying to play a game of priorities, because the assumption either is that they are full-on true believers, or they're just shysters. I mean, that's the only two people that are involved in this. And it's kind of funny trying to sit and read these articles and work out, like, you know, is this woman actually just someone who's willing to give £4 million to charity so they can turn profitable farmland that used to tend to cattle and what else into, like, a pond and a forest and stuff? Or is she actually making a couple of quid out of it, if not both?
There's this idea of, again, the settled science of Britain's biodiversity crisis, the climate crisis. It's all underpinned by this. Underpinned by the idea that if we don't do this, an apocalypse is coming.
Look at the little paragraph here in the quote. It's a circular problem, so I decided to find a way to cut through it. I lend money so the charity can buy the land, the charity repays me, and then I use that money to fund another project. That way I get to help rewild a lot more land for my money. Is she essentially admitting there that, like, it's a scheme.
And it's a land grab.
Yeah, it's an investment scheme.
It's an investment scam in which she obtains land by lending money to a charity that then leverages its amount of rewilded land against government funds. Holy shit, yeah, she's just saying it's not a circular problem, it's a circular scheme.
Yeah, no, she'll get her original money back and probably a dividend every year. Yeah. You're probably talking.
Well, she's saying, "Oh, that way I can buy more land." She's basically saying the government is in a roundabout way giving me money to buy up land and sit on it.
Yeah, I mean, what we can do as well is we can move on to the next piece that's here, because otherwise we'll start getting angry about this woman.
Yes,
but this is from Knight Frank, which I am not 100% aware of, but as it seems to be, is a relatively prominent property investor sort of magazine. It was one of the first things that actually came up when trying to look at rewilding and investing and stuff like that. And there's an article here from one of their people who it seems to be a, like, sort of agricultural specialist, and he's sort of just kind of taken aback briefly by all these, like, essentially celebrities and social who's and people with these moneyed classes showing up and wanting to buy farmland and wanting to pay over the odds for that farmland so that they don't farm on it.
It's the rewilding trend. Conservation and climate change are increasingly the driving the agricultural land market in the UK. So it's not even just a factor. They are the driving force behind it.
Yeah. I just love the quote. I've had 3 A-list Hollywood film stars get in touch this year because they want to buy a farm and rewild it. A senior member of a farm's estates team in London.
It's interesting because there's this idea that this is some sort of bottom-up change again. But this is the people.
Because it dobs them in here, he's talking about, in reality, it's not just about letting something go completely. It has to be a managed process.
Yes, it does. And what it's also basically saying is that this land is becoming, like, the fantasy wild earth plaything of these rich people in some ways, too. That they... Even if their motive isn't just to acquire land and drive up the price of land, because some investment firm somewhere will have clocked this, they'll be telling people to do this not merely as a performative thing, but as a scam, essentially. Someone somewhere has sussed this, because it is a circular process. You buy land, you receive grant from the government, and these NGOs manage it for you. You quote-unquote buy the land by lending the money to the NGO. The NGO pays you back more than you put in. You still have the land. They are just quote-unquote managing it to rewild it, and the cycle continues. It's interesting that this is coming up on an investment platform.
Yes.
Because they're talking now about the...
In my mind, finding this directly after the Guardian article just shows that there is clearly, there's an aggregation, whether it be multi-millionaires buying thousands of acres, which are mentioned in this article. I mean, it mentions the massive estate that BrewDog bought. I mean, I think I used their numbers roughly, and that'd have been, I think that was something like 20-odd million pounds worth of land, which a large amount of it has essentially been used as well as restoring degraded peatlands on their estate. So they've bought that to then turn it into an eco-scam to run their shit beer company.
Yes.
But inside of that, it's not just BrewDog. There are a lot of these middling people who are going out and buying, 100 hectares, 200 hectares, 300 hectares, and there's enough of them that, someone who's not even necessarily buying and selling farmland for the sake of farmland, but is looking at it as an investment strategy.
Look at these charts.
Mm.
Look at this. The long-term farmland price performance.
Which one's this? Is this the first one?
It's the first graph. It's the pound per acre.
Yeah. Well, we know why this has crashed, and this is the point we're going to get into, is that, farmland has all of a sudden... I mean, I'd need to find a quote actually in here. There is a word for word, he essentially explains that it seems to be marginal farmland is the major characteristic for those who are willing to sell up. And I think that relates back to your thing about
Look at the second chart, though. Farmland capital value changes versus other asset classes. Hmm. The only thing that is more valuable to buy up than farmland is gold. It has double the price performance of central London residential. It has, 75% more performance than the UK house price index in general.
Mm.
It is one of the best performing asset classes, which is why I think these people want to buy it up and want to specifically rewild it, because it ends up driving the price of arable land up even further.
There's a lovely wee one here. Farmland also still retains its safe haven reputation, says Hopkins. We are speaking to buyers who want somewhere safe to go in the event of another pandemic, and also to those who from overseas who view the UK as a stable place to move to if the political or economic situation in their own country deteriorates.
So Chinaman, basically, in America.
Book-pilled. Yeah, basically.
Yeah.
I'm just making sure there's nothing we miss here, really. No, I mean, the funny thing is that we then get the response to this. Let's say, these people aren't the only people that noticed it. It's not just the big brain folk. Bloody... Oh, that's not the right one. Bloody Monty Don of Gardener's World fame is ranting about, you know, how rewild is only for toffs. You know, again, he talks about 2030. He says 300,000 hectares, but I'm going to presume this article is possibly slightly older. But, you know, he's talking about the fact that you need a private income if you want to do this. You know, you need to be someone who's either already landed in some sense, or, you know, you can't commit yourself as a person to doing this as an investment and doing it wholeheartedly with your own time if you don't have some form of previously amassed wealth.
You must be an elite.
Yes.
You must already be a moneyed elite for this to make sense. So what they are doing is they are funneling money into their own pockets through these public schemes, through making rewilding economically viable. They are funding this mass expansion and consolidation of the land market. If you look, the Intelligence Lab article is actually a gold mine. Because if you look at the farmland supply...
Is this one of the bottom graphs? Oh no, sorry, it's the third one.
It's the third one. If you look at the farmland supply in acres from 2000 to 2021, it is insane, the drop. It's fluctuated, but it's insane from 2018 to 2021, the drop there. It is massive what has happened. If you look at the next graph as well, average Scottish farmland values, what they are doing is they are making worthless land
balloon.
Now speculatable. Yeah, balloon and speculator price. And it means that the land that these people hold that is not arable is now quote-unquote valuable. And what they can do is they can use that as an asset class they can now borrow against as well. This enhances their wealth greatly. And it's kind of funny that no one's really talks about this circular cycle of the fact that this is driving up land prices, farmland prices, removing arable land and creating a situation in which a handful of landowners... Because what will happen is, once these people are sick of this land and they move on to the next fad, the ones who are true believers, they'll give it back to these foundations, or they'll sell it to some land conglomerate.
I mean, if you look at the paragraph right under that, the best arable land is also in demand, with prices well over £10,000 an acre being achieved by several recent sales. Farmers in certain arable hotspots are still prepared to pay extraordinary prices, explains Tom. There is a feeling that as more farmland is returned to nature via rewilding or other environmental schemes, top quality food producing land will be more valuable.
It's the thing is that's a squeeze. It also makes British produce less competitive.
Yeah.
It makes farming in the UK less viable, and it makes us more reliant on imports.
Well, there is also the possible tie-in of a consolidation of the already existing farmers. I mean, this then makes it harder to break into farming, even though that was pretty much impossible at this point anyway. But, you know, if the costs of land are going to shoot up exponentially over the next, say, 2 or 3 years, because I know that rewilding scheme is basically going to be trialled in Wales and England and Scotland in a sort of staggered launch from now through into 2024 or 2025.
Let me read you the farm finance section in this article, because it's amazing. It says, from mortgages to agricultural lending, finance is going green. There's been a lot of talk for a long time. Indeed, banks have been setting their own target for sustainable lending for several years, but there's been a notable shift in recent months that will feed into favourable lending terms in the years ahead. Now, whenever I speak to lenders about finance for their agricultural client, they want to know if there is a green angle, whether it's for renewables, carbon capture, or wealthy estate owners seeking to set up, in quotes, sustainable farms. It's clear these are projects that banks want.
More Davos language.
It will mean in terms of more options for landowners. This drive stems from a tapestry of incentives pushing the industry into a greener future. Regulations are shifting to such a degree that lending against sustainable projects often constitutes less risk on a bank's balance sheet. So what they're saying is the government is classing green assets as a lower risk balance. So there's a massive incentive. That's huge. You can invest in essentially bottomless money pits, and the government will call it gold. Then there are the public relations advantages of having a greener book, as the UK government pushes the biggest institutions towards public disclosure of the environmental impact of the lending decision. So basically, if they don't do it for the credit incentive reasons, they're going to get, like, you know, Cultural Revolution style struggle sessioned by the UK government and activists.
Yeah. Well, there's a whole green Hegelianism that is allowing this to be driven. You know, there was once again, when it comes down to every leftist social issue, there are that core group of true believers. I mean, I can go and grab you one of them right now as a silly wee thing to laugh at before we get into some of the other stuff. But here is the chief, or the, what's this? An article by Sir David King, an advisor of the UK government, who's written a book called Man Swarm, How Overpopulation is Killing the Wide World. And he's doing an article for the Maine Rewilding Institute. I think this is one of the main international ones. It's been going since like the 90s. But this dude's the head of it. And it, you know, it almost in a Ted Kaye style bullet pointed kind of thing here. He's basically got like, I mean, it's almost written like a manifesto. It's hilarious. I guess this was the last link in the document, by the way.
Yes, I've got it up.
But the current population growth trend towards an ultimate stabilisation of 10 billion would render rewilding impossible and result not only in biodiversity loss, but massive extinction of the species rewilders seek to sustain and restore. In view of this, the goal of global population policy should be to stabilise the world's population and descend toward a goal of a sustainable population of 2 to 3 billion or less. He's talking about, like, getting rid of 2/3 of the people on Earth.
Yeah, he's talking about the possible death of 4 billion people. And this is just on rewilding.org, by the way.
But he's like, I like the specific measures for slowing, stopping and reversing population growth, and must include, you know, where's the educating, empowering women and girls? Oh my god, he's so based. He's worked it out. You know, these measures have been shown to often to lead to the demographic transition to low fertility, long life expectancy, and a higher quality of life. However, what I do find funny is this is the first ever environmental sort of think tank organisation or anything that I've come across that is actually against immigration. I mean, they've got a massive big like list here of copes and replies for it, but it's actually funny to see it. Like the guy that's written the book, you can see down here, is just that radical that he's like, nah, let's go for this.
Well, it's interesting because they're very elastic on immigration.
Mm.
It's basically, well, as long as we control it.
Yes. You know,
as long as we control it. It's funny. What's limiting family size is just on there.
Yeah.
Like a one-child policy.
Yeah. Provision of universal access to family planning. That's basically the same thing.
Well, reducing consumption basically means starving people to death.
Yeah.
In this situation. If you put reducing consumption and limiting family size together, it's the idea that what we have are, you know, rations per family unit. And if your family unit is too big to survive on the ration, that they die.
Mm.
That is the implicit in policy being proposed here.
Yeah. Right, I'm going to quickly rejig some of these links for a second.
That's very interesting. It's interesting that he's Sir David King, science advisor to the UK government.
Well, I would say I think that's him commenting on the book, but you'll see down at the bottom there's a different name, Dave someone else.
No, I'm just saying, he's the quote in the title.
Yeah.
And he's talking about, you know, biodiversity and the, you know, essentially the managerialists are trying to save us from this Malthusian disaster of their own creation.
Yeah.
Because the only way you've ended up with population shifts of this magnitude is due to uncontrolled mass immigration and welfare states and essentially socialist societies that have created this ballooning industry of childcare as income from the government that people don't need to earn to have children. What is it you're looking for? Sorry.
I'm just grabbing the last half of the links just now.
Have we gone through the Financial Times one yet?
I wasn't sure if we wanted to skip past that one. If there's something you want to go through it, we can quickly. I was going to get
It's funny, it just says rewilding is not just for private landowners.
Yes.
And they're basically talking about like these community. So basically talking about rewilding public land in many ways.
Well, sorry, I will grab this one actually because I think.
There's the independent link here about veg diet and rewilding could remove 100 billion tons of carbon dioxide.
All right, I can't even get into that FT article anymore.
Oh, I've skimmed through an archive link version of it, and it basically just says rewild public property using school kids.
I do think that one has a little name drop of the public-private partnership though. Which is always a nice one to see because that's very Davos man language again.
Yes, it is. But I don't think we need to go over that. You can briefly put it on the screen if you want. I'll send you a link.
I've got the independent one up.
Yeah. That's the FT one. But the independent one is interesting because this is leaning extremely hard on the climate angle.
Mm.
This is like peak climate angle on this one.
Yeah, I like the fact this is also written like 4 days ago as well, like the one thing I needed. I can't get the full article anymore again because the independent's just shit.
Would you like me to send you an archive link of that?
Nah, because really all I need is the title, to be honest, because you begin to understand the complete connection to the fact that, you know, you can't, I know it's a silly way to talk about it, but you can't grow meat without farmland.
Yes.
So if you're not going to be eating meat anymore, you're going to be eating a veg diet. And, you know, there is, like, the whole therapeutic state thing going on at the moment of trying to convince you that you're a good person when you eat a vegetarian diet, because if you don't, people might start having a panic attack when you realise there's no meat left.
The other side of this is we fucked up mass society so much, and we have deprioritised agriculture so heavily that you can no longer buy meat. The free market, in quotes, will no longer provide you with meat products.
Yeah. I mean, I do remember looking through this article, and it's more about the science aspect of it. But, you know, we are sold this idea that these new vegan products are being developed for the people in a way that they would want them. But they're being developed for the people because they need to be, as you're saying. You know, they've screwed up their own managerial organisation so much that they need to hide the fact that meat production basically needs to go. I mean, there was also someone making a point in chat. I mean, it's also sterilization, really, at the end of the day.
Yes. in many ways. Well, it's the stapling together of rewilding and the plant-based diet push is interesting here. Because I did a very, it turns out, rather controversial thread on Twitter about the fact that, again, the ideology is post-hoc. It's not that the government is trying to brainwash you into being a vegan. It's that they are using this rhetoric as to cover up the fact that, you know, like I said, you will no longer be provided with your meat ration, citizen, and here's why that's a good thing.
None dare call it collapse.
Yes. The issue with this article is that a lot of people will read it and take, you know, even the people who are against it will take away the wrong thing.
Are you talking about the independent one? Because I've got
all of them, really.
Yeah.
The issue with all of this is, again, that people will get angry at the quote-unquote loony leftists or the vegans or whoever it is who's being used as the ideological justification for this, instead of realizing that this is post-collapse propaganda. That the collapse has already happened.
Yes, well, that's the whole point. It's the same with economic phenomena. You know, the inflation is happening just now, but because people don't understand proper quantity theory of money or any other sort of things like Austrian business cycle theory, they only understand its prices. So if they can burn up the inflation and silly projects and, you know, rewilding and all this kind of nonsense, then people don't see it. Or if they keep it in an asset class that the average person never touches, like the actual price of agricultural land by the acre. You know, people don't read agricultural investment magazines, they don't care.
The subtitle here is, nature recovery schemes are part of post-Brexit subsidy overhaul. So this is something being done specifically by the UK government to fill the gap left by the EU in terms of these schemes.
Yes, essentially. This is the 80-seat majority conservative government engaging in national ecological schemes that ruin the nation's farmland. But I wasn't going to go through this one too much. It's just the general idea here, the fact that, the farmers will be given taxpayers' cash to rewild their land under plans for large-scale nature recovery projects announced by the government. These will lead to vast tracts of land being newly managed to conserve species,
Huge track salt, sorry.
provide habitats for wildlife and restore health to rivers and streams. It just carries on explaining it, but it's, this is not a natural aspect of society. Farmers didn't ask for this. But they're being bought out. Looking at the previous graphs, seeing the fact that the quantity of land's going away, there is a larger amount of marginal farms existing in Britain.
Well,
The government offers them £200 or £300 a week more than they would normally make off the land to take it off them and manage it as part of one of these trusts. Then why
the
not?
issue here is that what happens is, as we talked about earlier, this land, once it is rewilded, really cannot become arable again, or at
No.
least not under the structure of how it's zoned. What they're doing is they are rezoning land. So essentially, once the land is rezoned, the farmer no longer owns it. The trust, the bank, or the government does. So what this is functioning as is a mass transfer of land from small farmers into the hands of celebrities and NGOs, and then eventually into the hands of the government.
Yeah, well, not into the hands of hedge funds. Into
Yes.
the hands of the people that hold the pensions and all that kind of stuff.
Well, yes, but a lot of this, the framework that's being set up, it will be administered by the government.
Oh,
The
no.
schemes will at least.
Yeah, someone in chat said, again, it's just like a 2008 style bubble. I mean, not quite in the same way, but there is credit being given for this stuff, and not even necessarily just credit, but grants, which
Yes.
is a whole other kind of thing.
There is grants being given, and there is massive asset class, as we talked about in the previous article from the investment website you found. That shows that an entire asset class has been created that makes investing in these make your balance sheet better to a regulator, which means you can take out higher risk, higher reward investments in other areas. It's a very big tipping of the scales if you're a financial institution, say like the Lloyds Bank. They've not even properly started getting into this yet, the large financial institutions. They're gearing up and waiting for the incentive structure
Are
to make
we
even, more
going to have
sense
to
for them.
buy a couple of acres of farmland or something? Not just to make a couple of quid, but also to preserve it away from the hands of these people.
Possibly. God knows what they're actually going to be doing with this land.
Well, when you look at the I mean, it is Forged in Ashes in the chat, and I meant to ask him if he wanted to come on, to be honest. I thought he'd have seen the tweet anyway, but I should have asked him because I know he knows a thing or two about farming. But a lot of the rewilding stuff is not particularly supported even by my climate scientists because
No.
they understand that you basically need to bring all this machinery and stuff into the land and rapidly change it into something that it hasn't been instead of just like leaving it and allowing like wind and water erosion and a couple of centuries actually turn it back into like the wild, the landscape, as it were.
Yeah, it's artificial rewilding is the thing. What they are doing is they are turning this into essentially a theme park.
Well, I was gonna
A
say,
wilderness theme park.
if I go back briefly to the as in the Monty Don article somewhere, that he does
Yes.
actually mention that that they're not just letting land be land, or they're turning it into, they're turning it into a thing. It's become like almost in the same way Ted Kaczynski would talk about. It's like a surrogate activity, and
Yeah, it's.
this is a surrogate activity for the elite class, essentially. This is the 120 IQ midwits that we all laughed at a decade ago for doing, degrees in ecology studies and economics with environmental studies and economics and ecology and all this kind of nonsense, who are now probably going to get paid
Yes.
80, 90 grand a year because they genuinely believe that this stuff works, and
Yes.
they're going to think they've got a dream job because it's like, well, 3 days a week I'm in the field and 2 days a week I'm at the office, and they're not actually producing anything, they just exist as a part of the purely fiat economy. but it's
they have, yes.
They are being used because of, you know, what Burnham refers to in Suicide of the West as this innate liberal guilt. Because they've thrown away God, they've thrown away original sin, they've instead taken on the guilt of Gaia, if you will, and assumed that the human race collectively has abused the earth, and therefore it is their sole purpose to fix it by revolutionising some, you know, 140 acres in Surrey somewhere and get paid 90 grand a year to do it to save the world.
Yes. I mean, it is a big like priming engine subsidy of the quote unquote green economy that becomes, you know, it's like, well, of course these jobs are viable because we funded them.
Yeah.
So yes, of course there's a market demand for this because we've created the market.
Yeah.
Anything else you wanted to go over in terms of the sources here?
Well, I think we could get to what is possibly like a secret gem here from The Guardian. It's one of those ones where they get to say things they've made articles about that they call conspiracy theories. Then some intersectionist comes along and writes an opinion piece, and they just pretend it doesn't happen. And because this is all framed as like an attack on, you know, Native Americans and gays and whoever else, they get away with it. But they're talking about, as probably a lot of people know, that Bill Gates is buying up large amounts of land, and he's specifically buying up large amounts of farmland. You know, I think it's is now being the largest farmland owner in the world, or is it America or something like that?
He's the largest farmland owner in America. The only reason he's not the largest farmland owner in the world is because Monsanto exists.
That's very true.
He's certainly the largest private...
Yes.
I think he's the largest private landowner possibly in the world. No one's really quite sure because a lot of it belongs to his foundation and their subsidiary organizations, and there's a lot of shell games played here. But even directly tied to him himself... He is the largest private landowner in the United States, at least. Mm. We've had a donation here from Peter as well for $20 Canadian. Thank you, Peter. He says, in Canada, rewilding is not really a thing. However, indebted farmers or a farmer who wishes to work more land are encouraged to sell their land or purchase land on behalf of large investment firms. And then they'll rent it back to them.
Yeah.
Which is a model that's been going for a very long time, and how land centralization has worked since, you know, the 1970s. But that is a model there in Canada. Because the thing is, rewilding in Canada doesn't make any sense, because Canada is, like, largely unpopulated.
Well, yeah, it's the same reason, like, why are they doing it in Scotland? Everything north of the Cairngorms is some of the leastly... is essentially almost remote in comparison to most of the world. No, I mean, there is a lot of nonsense in this article. I mean, the indigenous peoples and the natives and blah, blah, blah. But there is just some fantastic stuff that's thrown in here that's... You know, it's like pure commie rhetoric, but they're kind of not wrong. You know, the gun and the whip may not accompany land acquisitions this time around, but billionaire class assertions that they are philosopher kings and climate-conscious investors who know better than the original caretakers are little more than ruses for what amounts to a 21st-century land grab, with big payouts and a for-profit economy seeking green solutions. Our era is dominated by the ultra-rich, the climate crisis, and a burgeoning green capitalism. And Bill Gates' new book, How to Avoid a Climate Disaster, positions himself as a thought leader on how to stop putting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere and how to fund what he calls elsewhere a global green revolution to help poor farmers mitigate climate change. What expertise in climate science or agriculture Gates possesses beyond being filthy rich is anyone's guess. I mean, they're going to start calling... you know, the eco movement a bourgeois revolution. I mean, they might not do it now, but they'll do it in like 3 or 4 decades' time.
But that's they will do.
I'm calling it that now. It's a bourgeois revolution.
Yes. It's also like, if you stripped out some of the anti-capitalist rhetoric here, and if you were a bit more bold with the language, this could be something that Sam Francis had written about, a class war of the managerialists against farmers.
Mm. Well, no, look, it goes further on, because Gates even admits what he's up to, which is hilarious. When pressed during a book discussion on Reddit about why he's gobbling up so much farmland, Gates claimed it's not connected to climate change. The decision, he said, came from his investment group, Cascade Investment. The firm is making these acquisitions is controlled by Gates, and the firm said it's very supportive of sustainable farming. It is also a shareholder in the plant-based protein companies Beyond Meat and Impossible Foods, as well as the farming equipment manufacturer John Deere. His firm's largest farmland acquisition happened in 2017 when it acquired 61 farming properties from a Canadian investment firm to the tune of $500 million. I mean, there's, you know, he's playing both sides of the coin. He's making money out of the racket of buying up farmland and a massive land grab, but he's also making a fortune off of growing fake meat so that the limited farmland's products, you know, are essentially outcompeted by this fake product that no one actually wants.
Yeah, it's a cheap substitute, and he's trying to, well, essentially what's happening is that these people are trying to make the meat market even more unviable, because they've seen the way that the wind is shifting because of mismanagement, and that they're trying to capitalize on it while it's collapsing.
Well, the article just continues on. Arable land is not just profitable. There's a more cynical calculation. Investment firms are making the argument farmlands will meet carbon neutral targets for sustainable investment portfolios. What a phrase.
This is the same thing that we just talked about.
Anticipating an increase of agricultural productivity and revenue, and while Bill Gates frets about eating cheeseburgers in his book for the amount of greenhouse gases the meat industry produces larger for the consumption of rich countries, his massive carbon footprint has little to do with his personal diet and is not forgivable by simply buying more land to sequester more carbon. And this is very true. I mean, these are the people who are getting... I mean, there's more stuff in this article about biodiversity and what have you, indigenous people. But, you know, like, if carbon credits are the new economy and you need land to leverage against your carbon credits because you're using the land to, in theory, take carbon out of the atmosphere, then, you know, he's getting in on the game before it started.
Yes. A lot of these people are. That's the thing, that if the carbon economy, you know, if the carbon credit score is going to be a thing, then they are getting out ahead of the game and positioning themselves as the kings.
Yeah. Whilst also gobbling up the last elements of meat. I mean, it's Bill Gates is being almost like a statesman here in the way that Wyndham Lewis described what the acts of statement were. You know, it is imposing socialist measures on the one hand, whilst, you know, the other hand, you're attending some speech about the dangers of socialism. You know, it's completely playing both sides to your advantage solely.
Yes, it is. It's again, the future we talked about was going to happen is one in which these people are essentially having some sort of hunter-gatherer LARP on their massive rewilded estates.
Yeah, well, we'll get to that. There's one last Reuters thing I want to look at.
Sure.
Which is just, it's Bill Gates talking at, I realise this is probably not going to be the best crop on the OBS thing. Sorry, it's just the format because it's a Reuters post. It looks crap. But it's essentially Bill Gates talking about investing something along the lines of, what was it? Oh, I had the number somewhere at some point.
Is it in the billions?
No, but I think it's something along the lines of, the Gates Foundation will invest $40 million in projects to develop livestock vaccines and make them accessible to the poorest small-scale farmers across Africa and South Asia through the Global Alliance for Livestock Veterinary Medicines, a public-private partnership based in Edinburgh. That's just a bunch of maniacal bastards sitting in an office in Edinburgh, like, praising Gaia and Moloch, and then deciding that they're going to make all the African people starve to death by giving their fucking cows herpes or some shit.
It does seem like another method for agricultural dependence. It's very Monsanto, your crops no longer make seeds.
Yeah. I mean, how is that nothing but sheer evil? I mean, given what's said, and, you know, if you know what Bill Gates talks about, and if you know what he's discussed on news articles when he talks about vaccines and what he thinks about public health and all these measures, he's essentially suggesting that he wants to see the world population come down, very much like that guy in the book that's referenced in the American Rewilding Organization.
Yes. It would also probably be a push to make unvaccinated animals illegal.
Yes. No, entirely. And I think that's already a thing in a lot of places. That is part of the reason why you can't have certain animal or certain meats and stuff like that, and butchers and what have you.
Yes. They're classed as like a health risk.
Mm. But what this is ultimately going to boil down to is, if these people truly believe this, you know, if those members of the new emergings of eco elites generally believe this, you know, I think the phrase I've used possibly for, and I know I have around you, is that Zuckerberg's kids will inherit the earth, and it'll be the Garden of Eden, and it'll look like this. It'll look at this picture by Mr. Dees here, who is
David Dees,
who is an incredibly prophetic man. I mean, I didn't know he discussed this, but as far as I can tell, that's what that is. You know, that is rewilding, essentially described by him, which is the sort of techno-industrial state keeping you out of the perfect wildlands that they've preserved for the very few, the small club. You're not in it.
It is like raw schizo posting, but it is also what's happening now.
Yeah, I mean, that's that is when I bumped into that investment article. That was when I thought, oh no, this isn't just like a silly eco scheme. This will happen one way or another because there's possibly enough true believers to fund a make work scheme, and there is also a subset of, you know, middle and top elites who are planning to make an absolute killing.
Yeah, they will do. It's the thing is, money doesn't matter to them, but if they can also get like all the land. Because these people are attached to the money printer.
Hmm.
It doesn't really matter how much money they have. In fact, at some point, the money becomes just completely immaterial and almost like a burden. And most, like, as is pointed out repeatedly, most people who are quote-unquote wealthy in a real sense are leveraged far, far in advance of their cash assets.
Hmm.
They, on paper, are massively indebted, but that is because of that. They are systematically rewarded for doing that. And what this allows these people to do is to plow, if you'll excuse the pun, their money into making this land unarable.
Yes.
And be rewarded for it by your taxes.
In short, essentially, yes. I mean, it's just it's such a fantastic racket. And it's one of those ones where you finally, you know, as you start to put the pieces together, you think, oh, that's clever. I don't know, maybe I'm
it is a very clever racket, yes.
Maybe I'm getting a bit Burnham-pilled, but it's like I can see what you've done there, and it's quite... Aye. There is enough levels of obfuscation that you need to kind of go through at least as many sources as we have, even to just see, you know, it's a bit like looking through the Matrix. We're looking at one set of the numbers, but there's loads and loads of layers behind that.
Yeah, there's a shell game of who's paying for it. And there's the misdirection of ideological rhetoric there. And there's an appeal to activism and NGOs. And this blind alley of, you know, the climate doom cult and all that. It plays into very much conservative biases in many ways. To allow you to get this false sense of what's actually going on.
Mm.
Which is just very, very simple. Well, it's a land grab.
Well, the thing is, if they're serious about this, though, this is going to have... You know, between now and 2030, if you live in somewhere in rural Britain, you'll see this. I mean, you'll see the local sort of fields around you turn into forests and rivers, and all of a sudden, like, your house is going to subside or something. It's just that there is going to be so many, like, it's the level of unintended consequences that are possible are actually beyond imagination, really.
Oh, sorry, I was having a good sneeze there. Yes, they are. They are... The thing is that, again, they don't quite know what they're doing. They don't know where this is going. They know it will benefit them, and they know it's going to lead to centralization. But as I try to explain to people, there isn't always... You know, it's not these people in this room talking exactly about this plan.
Mm.
Although there is an element of that. It's a lot of people are seeing which way the investment winds are blowing, and they are just going with it.
Yeah.
But they're desperate not to have a situation in which their asset classes end up underperforming compared to inflation.
Mm. Well, they end up impoverished. I'm seeing someone in the chat asking what can be done to counter this. I don't really know, to be honest, because I've never seen anyone really connect the dots while a lot of this stuff is we're at least trying to suggest might be the case. So I don't know. Share this about to folk who maybe have slightly more time to look into. I will too. But there will need to, at some level, be people who look into the specific numbers for these charities and these organisations and directly, you know, has the receipts in a sense and draws it all up together, because it's, you know, in the same way that it was done with a lot of the COVID stuff. I don't have access to all of that. I could try to.
No, I think one of the main things to do is, one, make people aware of it, and two, honestly, the only thing to do would be to get people with, you know, asset pools together to basically defend these farms.
Yeah.
Because this is an assault on the, you know, most people who own farms are already essentially making no money from them. It's very difficult to be profitable without these kind of schemes, without these green schemes.
We need to basically knock up like a prospective kind of like idea of what's going on here, who's involved, and then basically send it to tankies and like hard right people and get them to essentially start some form of like protest movement around protecting Britain's farms or something like that. Because surely
yeah,
some
save,
of the...
save British food, basically.
No, surely some of the... Because that's what it seems to be going on in that Bill Gates article in The Guardian, is that, I mean, part of the thing they're saying is that real environmentalism's never been tried, which is obviously stupid, and them showing themselves to be, you know, essentially trying to play harder into a Marxist dialectic ever so slightly than they want to play into the eco-dialectic just because it's convenient at the time. But
yes.
If there's got to be some subset of people, you know, that's a, I don't know, cringe thing to appeal to, but your Tony Benn kind of types.
Yeah.
Old British Labour Union types. They surely have got to be somewhat worried about this stuff happening. Maybe they just don't know.
I think it's a lot of them just don't know. That's the problem. I've been trying to connect with these people, and honestly, in some of the circles I've been in, I may or may not re-engage with them in future, but there is a depressing lack of people who possibly wouldn't turn you in is the issue. Once you start talking to establishment types, it may not be them, but it might be the people around them. You start to realize that you're probably at risk if you discuss too much with these people. Not even just like a Fed posting sense, but even just like getting across these useful ideas. If these reach the wrong ears at the wrong time, then oof, things start getting bad, or they start to realize what's going on.
No, that's true. And maybe this is just one of those things that we're too late on. You know, I'm aware of the fact that the rewilding thing seems to have been popularised over the last 5 years, but maybe people who were more aware at the time, I mean, I think we could go back to what looked like probably very hyperbolic material that was critical to the eco movement in the early 2000s, and I'd imagine maybe some of these people worked it out. I mean, if David Dees worked it out, surely someone else did.
Yes.
Maybe not quite in the way that they're referring to specific examples as we can now.
Well, I think if the rewilding stuff was proposed, say, pre-9/11, a huge amount of the outcry would be about the reduction of arable land and the undercurrent of guaranteeing depopulation and human suffering that is in this.
Yeah.
If you remove arable land, you make a country less productive food-wise, as its population is rising. You make them more dependent on food egg imports. You are essentially asking them to die in a famine at some point.
Well, but we will order food in from elsewhere, and people will remain eaten. I mean, this is always why they provide the other option, and they spend an absorbent amount of money in decades sometimes building you up and building you up and building you up from the hippie image of veganism to, you know, sports stars in the 90s and 2000s that were edgy and were vegan, you know, first vegan man to climb Everest or some nonsense like that. And then you get to now where Mo Farah's selling it. He's doing it in the Mobot, talking about how corn meat's making him run 16 double marathons, and it's not anything to do with the fact that he's, like, from Africa or anything like that.
Corned meat.
You know, if there has been a strategy, as we know with a lot of the environmentally interested stuff that since the 70s, near enough, in relation to making money out of this, possibly, then it's not unreasonable to suggest that the sort of vegan supplement, or not supplement, sorry, alternative food products, are, you know, has been pre-planned as well.
I would at some point, and I'm going to probably have to do it in... It's actually one of the notes I've got for the post-democratization stuff, is to talk about the effect that World War II had, especially on food, and how it was the birth, really, of the modern food industry.
Yes.
And how, really, the managerialist birthed this idea of, you know, mechanically reclaimed processed meat. Because processed meat products are a product of warfare. They are a product of the mass state in a war footing, really. The idea that people got used to, you know, spam is a wartime product.
That and a lot of the preservation techniques that stayed, which is an even sort of more, sort of slightly deeper and substantive level, because now you've got essentially all meat and fruit and produce products going through, you know, an extra chemical process as just the default. The idea of, like, giving you the food and it's sort of a clean state is... That doesn't seem to happen unless you do these things that they had to do just to make the food last
longer.
There's
a lengthening of supply lines. There's the idea of, you know, food importation as a viable industry rather than having to rely on local land and the population limit that imposes. And a lot of people see that as a bad thing, but in terms of, like, resilience to collapse, it is essential.
Yes.
And it is one of the things that was forcibly... People really wanted to maintain this. It was an idea that was very, very present in people's minds, especially pre-1900. Mm. But it's almost completely fallen by the wayside. It's what we refer to in passive terms as food security. And that really just means that you're trading with two South American nations to get 50 tons of peaches rather than one, in their mind. It has nothing to do with the fact that society is structured in such a way that if some small incompetence, not even malice, would have happened on the part of the managerialist, that millions of people would starve overnight because they are reliant on these spider web systems that don't make any sense because they're such, you know, you talked about the having to make processes more and more roundabout for them to become profitable in these systematized worlds. Well, that's what the food industry has become. It's become, you know, so roundabout that you are no longer able to viably feed yourself in a period of strife.
Well, because unironically, the time preference for food is higher, and the higher time preference for food will persist despite the fact that the credit structure may change in a way that means that, you know, the food you were buying before is nowhere near in the same way it was, but you're willing to accept it because you're like, well, food, I need food.
The issue as well, and it's something I'm probably going to talk about this at length if we ever undertake something like I want to with the food industry and how it relates to the expansion of the mass state, is that people talk about the fact that food and meat was more expensive in the past, in the 1940s and the 1930s. But when you look at what people were buying, it is the equivalent of hand-reared boutique food that we see now that is the preserve of the elite class.
Well, I was going to say there was a thing floating about on Twitter the other day where it was like Polish World War II meat rations. The boy was sitting with a 2.5 kilo lump of beef. How many families in Britain nowadays eat 2.5 kilos of beef amongst them? I mean, that's...
I get fresh, not processed beef.
I don't mean minced. I mean, a big cut, you know, maybe it's a hock, a rump. Still, that's 20-odd quid's worth of beef.
Yeah. Maybe even, like I said, that'll be hand-reared. Mm. It won't be chemically farmed. It won't be pumped full of steroids.
I think they had if something like a kilo and a half of butter as well, and like 6 or 8 pints of like milk.
Again, this would be equivalent of extremely boutique, organic, you know, locally sourced, the produce that you see people buying from farm shops that they pay what you would consider unobtainable prices for. That just used to be people's diet.
Well, I mean, even in the sense of, you know, Poland, it might have been communist rations, not World War II rations, or the brief period of communist Poland or whatever. It was the rations given to you by the government quantified that, and that people nowadays don't even consider that as like a component of their diet, because through education, as is always the trick, they've been taught that, you know, all sorts of just dietitianry related nonsense, in short.
Yeah, it's very red meat gives you cancer, and eat this, it's low fat. But the wider issue is that this is a just one in a long line of like degradation of the normal one, the normal farmer, and two, the normal consumer, into a state where he, you know, has to eat the bugs. But
entirely, it all comes hand in hand. And it's always so sort of blunt object when you begin to look at it in the way that we have. I mean, I think that's, to go back to the image we've got in front of us, the reason why there's a big robot point gun is because it's just such a blunt instrument of policy to engineer society in the way that they want, because the outcome they need is not you to eat a nutritious diet. You just need to eat enough so that you can go do your 14-hour shift in the Amazon cages.
Well, it's also a... If you look at it in a like theological sense, it is a bastardization of like Eden, the idea that the earth is not meant for man, and that these areas need to be devoid of the, you know, men.
Well, see,
or devoid of at least the common man.
It's almost like going right into, you know, a really sort of Hegelian notion of, you know, no one owns it, quote unquote. No one owns it. The public owns it. And it's last great thing to be done with the lands of the earth, is to do this so that the people may thrive on it. But the people in that terminology there, as it always means, is some high level of society who get to enjoy the luxuries that no one else does.
It's also, it's reverse Lockean homesteading. What they are doing is they are unhomesteading the land while simultaneously reappropriating it from its original appropriators to an elite class.
Are we going to get to 2030 and they're going to EMP us and be like, right, troops, round two, here we go.
Basically.
we'll all stand at the start line in like Greenwich or something. 3, 2, 1, make the break for America.
Oh, dear. But it's in like the... In the sense that, you know, let Eben and classical liberals see this flawed idea of, you know, perfect man in nature, which is fixed by a lot of the kind of Hoppean idea of natural rights and natural law being different. But it is very much almost like a reverse of that. If you think of as of the bounty of Eden as meant for man, or the bounty of the earth as meant for man, it's a very strange inversion of that. And I'm not going to start getting into my satanic inversions again, because people think I've not been taking my meds. But it very much is this upside down idea of, you know, the environment. Man serves the environment. The environment doesn't serve man.
Well, see, I think it already partially really exists in a lot of like UN and EU directive law that doesn't really exist, only exists when they need to invoke it, sort of stuff. But I think that the right to a clean environment and things like that are... They already exist in law. I mean, there was already the precedent, or not the precedent, but there very soon could be the precedent there. Like, if you're not acting in accordance with helping these programs, you are going to become a climate terrorist.
Yes.
You know, you're going to see false flag climate terrorist attacks that allow the rewilding movement to mainstream itself.
Or you'll just get the same social pressuring rhetoric you do with the vaccinated.
Sorry, GCHQ is at the door.
Was that a knock on the door?
No, I was joking.
All right, I thought you meant someone was actually knocking. Might be the milkman again.
Probably.
Well, I don't think we have run out of milk since then. But
no, we haven't. Luckily enough, that's why he's never rematerialized.
He's gonna come back one day. No one knows what we're talking about, so we should probably end the stream there. Is there anything you want to shill before we do?
Not that I'm aware of. I don't know if we have plans for Thursday. I'm kind of busy with appointments and stuff.
I will be streaming on Thursday, come what may. I might just do a me and Trig slightly more fun stream. We've been very, very, very in-depth with theory recently. I might just do a bit of a more fun community stream with Trig. That's what I was thinking for Thursday.
Cool.
Bit more questions in chat, a bit more catch-up, a bit more free-form, and a little bit more upbeat, a little bit more silly.
Yeah, I'm thinking Monday next week, I may do one stream that should then relate to another. I just need to work out what order they go in, but it might be a continuation of the canon of Hoppe and Leninism. And as far as Substack articles go, I'm not too sure.
I'm still reading.
Yeah.
I keep finding stuff that I would need to read before I write something, so it's probably going to be a little while, but they're going to be good. There's going to be a lot of good quotes in there.
I'm sort of reading a lot as well, and between that and organising events and whatever else, and trying to, I don't know, I'm sort of trying to prioritise streams at the moment instead of written content.
Yes, I don't know, I will actually go through a little bit of some of my article ideas, because I've been, the thing is, there's an article I've got that is basically called The Worship of Man and the Need for the Divine, but there's about two different books I need to read The Sacred and the Profane, and I need to read what you're reading currently, which is The Politics of God and the Politics of Man by Alul. I'm working on an article, I could possibly finish my Brutalism article, because that's quite far on. You know, that's just called Brutalism, the Architecture of the Managerialists. The problem is, there's been a lot of architecture discourse recently, and I think it's a bit far away from what we need to be talking about. There's a lot of people that get very autistic about high-rises or the pros and cons of them, and it's more about the social engineering aspect of it, but I don't want to get it lumped in with that. I've got an article about AI called, basically, the idea that communists want to solve AI with solve the calculation problem with AI, called Communist Machine Gods. I have an article called What Actually Scares the Elite, which I need to factor in. I think I've got some Schmidt in there and some of Nemesis, but I also want to read more De Juvenal in general before I finish that one. And yeah, there's a couple more that I've got that I'd also like to read more TED for as well, stuff like the homeless industrial complex, because I think there's some great stuff about that, basically about the lack of the frontier that causes this phenomenon.
Do you mind if I steal the AI one, because I still want to get round to doing like a Misesian interpretation of the calculation problem that essentially rebukes the idea of that.
I will let you have my notes then. I've got an article that I'm researching about NGOs, but I'm currently working through a spider's web of other people's freedom of information requests, so I can actually figure out where money is going. Mm. But that's about laundering government policy. And I also have my notes for the I did a thread that took off called The Holy Mountain about the idea that ideas of the sacred end up falling to cultures that do have ideas of the sacred.
Yes.
But again, there's other stuff I need to read.
Mm.
And a lot of that was prefaced around some of the ideas of, like, using Afghanistan and the war on terror as a springboard to talk about the fact that, you know, essentially those goat farmers in Afghanistan, even though they were a bit subverted by the CIA, survived the Americans because they believed that their land belonged to Allah, and they believed that these were Muslim lands.
Mm.
And that ultimately is the core of what drove them. But again, there's a lot of stuff that we're working on, but there's a lot more spiritual stuff in terms of the right-wing thinkers like Alul, like Carlyle especially. You've read Carlyle, but I haven't. I wouldn't want to write any of these before finishing the reading that I'm currently doing. I think I would, as I've done previously, I would encounter stuff and I'd be like, I shouldn't have written that before I read that, because I'm able to phrase things in a much more efficient manner by using what other people have done before, and it allows me to be a lot more focused in the conclusions. But that's what's going on with the writing, by the way. We are both like developing a lot of article ideas. I have a lot of stuff kind of skeleton pre-written, but like I said, there's a lot of other people's work I'd like to get through because there's a lot of stuff I haven't read yet. So anyway, I will say goodbye from me if there's nothing else that needs shilling. There will, like I said, there will be a Thursday stream, a bit more of a free format one. Do look out for us. Links below where you're, I know me and you are both on Gab now. I'm still on Minds. I post there occasionally. We're still on Twitter. We're just going to spread ourselves as wide as possible as the net is still tightening. But thank you for tuning in today. Is there any other final point you want to make, Evelyn?
What I might ask actually is, if people would be interested, I would be happy to make a channel like Telegram, and I would basically just post the links for the videos, what's happening with articles and stuff, and then maybe just like snippets or links to threads from other social medias, so that we could essentially use a Telegram channel as like an aggregator for all the stuff that me and you are doing or saying.
I think that would be quite useful. I think, you know, without getting reply to that, I think you should probably do that because people have been asking for that, so that'd be quite useful.
I don't know. God knows what I'll call it, but...
We'll figure something out. So look out for that. I'll try and keep you guys updated, and we'll see you another time.
Goodbye.